Jeff Bridges is one of those rare actors who always seem to become the character he's playing. And over the course of his impressive career, he's inhabited more than a few memorable movie characters, including The Last Picture Show, for which he got his first of four Oscar nominations, The Fabulous Baker Boys, Fearless, The Great Lebowski, The Contender. If, as Harlan Howard says, country music is three chords and the truth, then there's an awful lot of truth to be found in his latest film called Crazy Heart, where he embodies Bad Blake, a battered, around-the-edges country singer. The film also stars Maggie Gyllenhaal and Robert Duvall, and it opens this Wednesday at Lincoln Center and the Angelica, and I'm very pleased and honored to have this opportunity to speak to Jeff Bridges today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Great to be here.
Well, you've played musician before in The Fabulous Baker Boys. You played a pianist.
Mm-hmm.
But since you've recorded a CD some years back, was this easier because you could do your own singing?
Yeah, probably was. I mean, I loved doing the Baker Boys. That was wonderful. I play a bit of the piano, but guitar is my main instrument, and I've been playing and writing music since I was a teenager, you know, so this was great fun, and also that I had an opportunity to work with T-Bone Burnett and Stephen Bruton, my dear old friends.
And they wrote the music for this?
Yeah, they wrote some of the music. The music that we just heard there, the song Hold On You, was written by one of my oldest friends, John Goodwin. We go back to the fourth grade together. We've been writing music and making art and dancing all these years, and so it was wonderful to have him on board.
Well, often in films of this sort, the music isn't as good as the real stuff. It's sort of like an approximation. But in this case, you have the same people who write the real stuff, and it does sound just like the sort of thing we might hear on the radio.
Yeah, that was a very important element for me. Originally, you know, when the script came to me first, I turned it down because there was no music and there was no one at the musical helm, you know, and like you mentioned, the Baker Boys, we had all those wonderful jazz and pop classics, and we had Dave Grusin doing the music, and when I first read the Crazy Heart script, there was none of that, so it was about a year later that I ran into my buddy T-Bone Burnett, and he said, "Have you read the script?" And I said, "Yeah, why are you interested?" And he said, "Yeah, if you are, if you'll do it, I'll do it." So that missing piece fell into place, and we were off and running.
Well, the songs obviously are also connected to the plot in the way that a musical does it. In fact, Bad can sing things that he would have trouble actually saying to someone, like when he sings the lyrics, "I used to be somebody, now I'm somebody else."
Yeah, right.
Those lyrics encapsulated his character in a way.
In a way, you know, I think he probably wrote that song on the way down, you know, after he had a certain degree of fame. And he's probably writing about not being famous anymore. But another way of looking at those lyrics, you know, is that you don't have to be who you think you are. You know, they can work, can be the flip side of that, too. So, yeah, the lyrics and that song and all the songs are really wonderful. Another artist that gave us a song was Greg Brown. I don't know if you're familiar with his music, but he's a wonderful singer-songwriter. And also this young guy, Ryan Bingham, who wrote the title song of the movie that plays it all throughout the movie. And he also plays a part in the movie. He's a big up-and-coming country star.
In your CD a few years ago, Be Here Soon, David Crosby was also featured.
Yeah.
But what kind of music were you playing on that? Similar to what you're doing here?
No. My friend Johnny Goodwin, who I mentioned earlier, he has a few songs on there.
Mostly country-ish?
But no, it's not really country. It's kind of more eclectic. It's, you know, it's more poppy, rocky, you know, some jazz elements in there. My good buddy Michael McDonald helped produce that album, and he sings on it and plays on it. It was, you know, wonderful to work with him.
In this case, you're all alone, naked. I was thinking about this guy, Bad Blake. Do you think he was more of a songwriter than a singer? What kind of a career did he have before he wound up playing dives in bowling alleys?
Yeah, he was the whole. A whole thing, you know. He was a great singer, great songwriter. One of the first directions that Scott Cooper gave me, who also wrote the script, was that if Bad Blake was a real character, you know, he would be one of the he would be the fifth highwayman. And the highwaymen were, you know, it was a group with Johnny Cash and Waylon and Willie and Christopherson. And so that was a nice guide for me.
Well, if he were a real person, he'd have cirrhosis of the liver.
Well, yeah, that's probably true, too.
Because most of the singing you do when your character's drunk.
That's right.
Now, I know that actors will always say, well, if you're playing somebody who's drunk, you don't act drunk. But I don't know how that applies when you're singing and you're drunk.
Well, you know, it's kind of amazing. And actors are like this, too. You're this, a lot of stories of wonderful actors who are able to get up on stage and, you know, do whole performances completely inebriated, you know, and they're able to remember their lines and everything. And I think that goes for Bad, you know, when he's up on stage. That's his, you know, his throne. That's his home turf. He can be however he wants to be, and that's perfect.
Well, he hides a lot from people, only less and less once he meets this reporter, the turning point, Jean Craddock, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal. Why would he open up to her? I mean, other than the fact that Maggie Gyllenhaal is gorgeous.
I'm looking for love. I'm looking for intimacy. You know, he's like a lot of these guys, married several times. You know, he really is, really loves love, and is looking for it wherever he can find it. What's the real thing?
I've heard that clothes play an important role in how you figure out your character. Did you look in your own closet to work out this character?
Sure, I always start there, and I'm trying to think. I don't know. There were some things, but it's also one of the fun things about making movies is that it's a collaborative art form, so you get to benefit from all these other experts, you know, and I really really look towards the costume designer on this one to, you know, help find those shirts and the jeans and all those different things that would make this guy seem real. And also Stephen Bruton, who I mentioned before, he was my role model, really, my main role model, and he was with me every step of the way. So, rather than looking at my own wardrobe, I looked at his wardrobe. You know.
Well, in a way, this is also a return to your movie roots, because country music played a big part in the last picture show. Bad Blake is conflicted between doing real country and perhaps selling out like his former partner Tommy Sweet, played by Colin Farrell in the film. Do you like country music?
I do. Because
you grew up in Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's not exactly a big country music town, is
no,
it?
No, no. But I'm a big fan of country music. It's funny. The beginning of my experience with this movie really starts 30 years ago with a movie called Heaven's Gate. And that's where I met Stephen Bruton and T-Bone Burnett, who were buddies with Kris Kristofferson. And Kris is also a model for me in this movie. And in Heaven's Gate, we would jam, you know, every night after work for 6 months. And so that's where the music for this movie really started.
Didn't Stephen Bruton just pass away?
He did. And the movie's dedicated to him.
There's a real death cult in country music. I'm not talking about Stephen Bruton, but you have Jimmy Rogers dying young, Hank Williams, Lefty Frizzell. These are all people who lived really hard lives.
Yeah.
Sort of like what Bad Blake is all about.
That's right.
But what do you think it is about that genre? We jazz musicians had a rough time for a while, but we don't hear much about jazz musicians doing that sort of thing anymore.
Yeah, this is tremendous pressure and of performing and coming up with the goods, and I think there's kind of a myth that they create about themselves, and it's a vicious circle that's very hard to get out of, where they're writing tunes, and the tunes are often about their own pain and their suffering, and so it's like a vicious circle where I've got to keep that pain going so I can write my songs, you know. And so they don't mind, you know, getting drunk and losing marriages and everything. I say, well, it'll make a good song. What the hell?
Well, I was wondering whether Bad Blake was modeled on somebody in particular at times. He seems like Waylon Jennings. One of Waylon's songs is used on the soundtrack, and your guitar strap kind of looks like mm-hmm. Waylon's.
Yeah. There were, you know, all those guys were role models. I know Scott Cooper originally wanted to write a movie and direct a movie based on Merle Haggard's life. But like Bad, Merle had many wives, and the rights, you know, were very difficult to get from them. So he decided to make a movie that was based on this book by Thomas Cobb, Crazy Heart, and he could take elements of Christofferson and Waylon and all of these guys.
Well, there seems to also be a connection with Billy Joe Shaver in the movie. Robert Duvall sings one of his songs.
Right.
We've got to Live Forever at one point. Is this the first time you ever worked with Robert Duvall?
It is. We've known each other for years, you know. But this is the first time we've ever worked together, and that was a real dream.
Well, he also he's portrayed a famous down and his luck country singer in Tender Mercies.
Yeah, wonderful movie, yeah.
Your scenes with him do feel very comfortable. Is that something that can happen even if you don't know a person?
Yeah, that's... well, for instance, I didn't know Maggie Gyllenhaal or Colin Farrell, who are also in the movie.
Because I always wonder about that chemistry
thing.
Sometimes it really does seem to happen, and other times you wonder why it didn't happen. These are professional actors.
Yeah, that's one of the challenges of acting is to create that illusion that you've known each other and how you go about it. Some actors really turn it on between action and cut, and they really don't want to know too much about you between that mm-hmm. time. Other actors really like to kind of get intimate, get to know each other, and then they put what they've learned about, you know, the other person up on the screen. That's sort of my methods, and the challenge of that is that you don't have too much time to get to know each other, so you... But one of
how many times have actors told me, well, the first time I met this other actor, we were naked in bed together.
I know. It's so crazy. But there's something. I remember doing an acting exercise in Theater West, a theater group I used to belong to, where we were encouraged to... this is maybe not a good way to... I don't want to tell that. That's too long of a story. But I'll make it short this way. If you're playing a king... and the guy you're playing with isn't treating you like a king, you're not a king, you know. But if the guy is treating you like a king and you're acting like a king, then something happens between you. And it's the same thing in a relationship. When you get two actors that open their hearts together, it happens very quickly. And it's kind of a magical thing and wonderful to be a part of, you know. And that was really evident, I think, with Maggie and Colin both. Because Colin... flew in for like 4 or 5 days as long to create that relationship that quickly. You got to be open and really game to show your stuff. And he certainly was, and so was Maggie.
I had to do it in a foreign accent.
There you go. That's right.
But the audiences notice, because one of the ways that you do feel that people are connecting on screen is eye contact. If they're listening... Mm-hmm. And you get the feeling, I've gotten this feeling on watching a play or in movies, that the other actor is just waiting for you to shut up so that he can say his line.
That's right. That reminds me of one of my first lessons that my dad ever taught me when he was, you know, teaching me acting for a role in Sea Hunt. He used to sit me on the bed and say, now, don't just wait till my lips stop talking. You know, listen to what I'm saying, you know. And
my guest is Jeff Bridges, who stars as Bad Blake in Crazy Heart, which opens this Wednesday at Lincoln Center and the Angelica. We will continue our conversation after this.
Be somebody, but now I am somebody else. I used to be somebody.
We're back with Jeff Bridges, who stars as Bad Blake in Crazy Heart, also starring Maggie Gyllenhaal and Robert Duvall. The film opens this Wednesday at the Lincoln Center and the Angelica. Does it matter whether you're doing the real singing or playing, whether you're just lip-syncing somebody else?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I see a movie, you can kind of tell, you know, and I think it pulls you out of the movie when it's somebody else.
Audrey Hepburn was really upset when they wouldn't let her sing her own songs in My Fair Lady.
Oh, I know, right? Absolutely.
Well, it also allows you to get into the character more, I'm sure.
Sure.
Susan Sarandon once called you the most underrated actor working, and she said your real self disappears when you're in character, which might be why he's not as high profile as he deserves. You don't get the feeling it's important to him to be front and center. I'm sure you've wondered why. I think the actors, the ones who become the biggest stars, are often the ones who become personalities rather than actors who really just make their character come alive.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of that, I think my approach to all of that comes from seeing the frustration my father had, Lloyd Bridges, who was a very versatile actor. Not too many people know that he replaced Richard Kiley in Man of La Mancha on Broadway.
We mostly associate him with...
with Sea Hunt, right? Mm-hmm. And he pulled off Sea Hunt so well. This is the TV series back in the 60s that people thought he was a skin diver. And so he got a lot of skin diving scripts offered to him. And that was very frustrating for him. You know, I remember years later, I was doing a movie called Blown Away, and there was a part of my uncle. And I suggested to the producers that they might consider a wonderful actor who looks a bit like me, Lloyd Bridges. And the producer laughed and said, "Your father is a great actor, but he's really thought of as more of a comedian." And I said,
What
are you talking about? And he said, "Well, the Airplane movie." He had done a couple of comedies, you know. And so my dad had to come in and read for the part, you know, which he was happy to do. But I noticed... you know, how frustrating it was for him. So I really went about trying to mix up my different roles and not developing too strong a persona for a number of reasons. One, it keeps it more interesting for me, and it also sends a message out there to the filmmakers that I can play, you know, different things so I get different types of roles. And the most important thing, though, is that I think it lets the audience, by not having such a strong persona, project the character that I'm playing with more ease. You know, they can see me in those parts.
Well, you're not easily typecast because
there
of your career.
Right.
But was watching your father a reason that you seem to be ambivalent even more than your brother about going into acting? I gather even after you were nominated for an Oscar for The Last Picture Show. That's, you were 22 at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you think you wanted to do when you grew up?
Well, you know, my dad, unlike a lot of Hollywood, you know, actors or showbiz guys, he loved show business and wanted to turn his kids onto it. And so all of us, you know, really got into showbiz through his enthusiasm. I was brought on at 6 months, you know. And I remember doing Sea Hunt, you know, he would come up to me and say, "Hey, you want to be in Sea Hunt?" You know, I said, "Oh." And he said, "You get to get out of school, you know, get some money.
That's incentive.
Yeah, you can make some money, buy some toys. Come on, you know." I said, "Okay, you know." And it came pretty easy to me, and I enjoyed it, but there was a downside to it. You know, as a kid, you don't want to be special. You know, you don't want to stand out in any way. You want to be one of the kids. You don't want to have a famous father, really, and you especially don't want to be thought of someone who got a job because of who your father was. But was certainly the case in my case. I was, you know, a product of nepotism. You know, the hardest thing in acting is getting your foot in the door, and that was handled. I was thrown through that thing, you know.
And a lot of actors resent other actors who
have famous parents.
Oh,
of course. And then there's the whole thing about being a kid. Just, you know, you don't want to do what your parents want you to do. You know, whether you're...
So when did it change for you?
The change happened about, I'd done about 10 movies.
Really?
Oh,
that
yeah.
Much?
Oh, yeah. And I thought, you know, that I wanted to be a musician, you know, for one thing, and or paint. I mean, interested in a lot of different kinds of
artistic things. You've done photography.
And photography, a lot of other things. And I was doing, I just finished a movie called The Last American Hero. And I had a good time making it, but as often is the case, I feel kind of exhausted. There's a muscle, you know, the pretend muscle or whatever you want to call it, that gets exhausted, you know, after you're pretending to be somebody else. You feel like you just want to be yourself, you know. And I got this offer about a week after that movie. My agent called me up and said, John Frankenheimer wants you to do The Iceman Cometh with Robert Ryan and Lee Marvin, you know, and Frederick March. And I said, no, I'm going to pass. He said, you're going to pass? I said, I'm bushed. I just, you know, thank them very much for me. You know, it's an honor to be asked, but no thanks. And about 5 minutes later, Lamont Johnson, who directed Last American Hero, called me up. He's got this really low voice, and he said, you call yourself an actor. You disgust me. And I said, what do you mean? He says, you turned down this great opportunity. And I said, I'm bushed. He says, you're bushed. You're a fool. And he hung up the phone.
So, well, most actors would be thrilled to be performing with all those other great actors.
Yeah, but I just didn't feel like it, you know. So then I thought I would do a little experiment on myself. And I said, well, you know, I understand to be a professional, you have to do it when you don't feel like it. I certainly don't feel like it. And I'm about the age now where I'm wondering what I really want to do. So maybe this will be the nail in the coffin of me being an actor. I'm going to test myself. So I did the film. And it was a unique experience for a lot of reasons. One was that if you're lucky, you get a couple weeks rehearsal and you shoot for 8 or 10 weeks on a normal movie. And this one was kind of turned around where we rehearsed for 8 weeks and then shot for 2 weeks. And it's a long play, you know, Eugene O'Neill. It's about 4 hours all on the same set. And Frankenheimer designed it in a beautiful way where there were long, long takes. And so we basically, you know, rehearsed it as a play. And just hanging out with those masters, you know, for all of that time and learning things from all my, most of my scenes were with Robert Ryan, who was a wonderful actor, and learning from those guys and having such a wonderful time. I said, I can do this for the rest of my life.
Well, you've worked with some extraordinary people, like, well, Ben Johnson in Last Picture Show, John Huston in Fat City, Clint Eastwood in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, Francis Ford Coppola in Tucker, Teddy Gilliam in The Fisher King, Frankenheimer with Lee Marvin and Frederick March, Ridley Scott, Robert Benton, Peter Weir, Hal Ashby. I mean,
oh man,
there are a few actors who've been that fortunate, and I'm assuming you, at a certain point, you thought, gee, I could learn a lot from these guys.
Oh, I didn't even think about it. I certainly did learn a lot from all those guys. I've had a wonderful, wonderful career. We're very lucky.
And yet, younger audiences probably know you best for Iron Man and The Big Lebowski.
That's it, yeah.
Does that bother you at all? Or can you get... are you being offered a lot of Iron Man type roles now?
No. I try to scatter it around. I remember after The Big Lebowski, I read, I was kind of holding out for different things, and I read this wonderful script of The Contender, where I got to play the president of the United States.
Joan Allen's husband. Her predecessor.
She was playing a senator in it. And, or a congresswoman, I can't remember. And remember the director, writer, Rod Lurie, you know, a wonderful, wonderful guy. He said, just think, the dude is the press. And that kind of set the hook for me. I said, yeah, let's go.
You also, we mentioned photography. You have a reputation as an unofficial behind-the-scenes photographer on an awful lot of movies. 50 movies?
Oh, yeah, probably a little more than that, but yeah.
And has that always been something you wanted to do?
With the photography, you mean? Yeah, I fell in love with this particular camera, the Widelux, My wife gave me my first one as a wedding gift 33 years ago. I first became aware of the camera when I was in high school. And there was a rumor going around that the guy who was going to take our class picture had a camera that panned, the lens panned, and if you ran around really quick, you could be in the picture twice. And that rumor was true. You could do that. And you know, you see these pictures of the Civil War or what are these long kind of pictures. They're taken with this type of camera. It's one of the older shutter mechanisms. And I fell in love with that camera, and it's almost like a 70-millimeter film format. So it really lends itself well to taking pictures behind the scenes.
Have you ever thought about directing?
I thought about it, and I would like to do that before I kick the bucket. I'd like to do it, but I know what it takes. You know, it's a year or more out of your life, and you got to be really passionate about something. Nothing like that has rolled around right now.
We have about 10 seconds left, mm-hmm. but you have three daughters. Have they shown any interest in acting?
Not really. Unlike my father, I wasn't very proactive about that, but they're all very talented that way. It wouldn't surprise me if they fell that way.
Jeff Bridges stars as Bad Blake in a new film called Crazy Heart, which opens this Wednesday at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema and at the Angelica. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Nice talking with you, Leonard. Thanks a lot.
On tomorrow's show, we'll look into the efficacy of standardized tests in education with a man who spent 15 years working in the industry. Then Kristen Johnston on her star turn as the diva of all divas in So Help Me God. I'll speak with two of the writers commissioned by the Flea Theater to write short plays on the Great Recession, and 12-time Emmy Award winner and 60 Minutes legend Morley Safer discusses his long career in broadcasting. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we have help today from Angela Sheldon and Josh Bell. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.